in a blog post that was widely shared, the musician Morrissey slammed the music industry, the media, celebrities, and others. He said, "We're hypocritical and cynical for paying tributes to Sinead O'Connor only after her death." He wrote in part, "You praise her now only because it's too late. You hadn't the guts to support her when she was alive and she was looking for you." We're going to end it there, but continue our discussion with Allison McCabe, music journalist and author of the book Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. Her new piece for Vulture, Sinead O'Connor Was Always a Protest Singer. And thank you so much to Jamie Manson, president for Catholics for Choice. We'll speak to you both about Sinead O'Connor and post it at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for paid internships in archive and development departments. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Listen to Black Book Talk at KBOO FM every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon. Co-hosts O.B. Hill, Patricia Welch, and Emma Jackson Ford discuss African-American authors and books. That's Black Book Talk every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon on KBOO FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Miles Sylvie, intern at Street Roots, about his new article, Rubber Meets the Streets, Privilege, Ability, and Legality, the Politics of PDX Cycling. Welcome, Miles.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. So your article talks about the tension between affluent cyclists and bicyclists of lower income, including homeless Portlanders. For folks who may be new to the issue, how does the Portland cycling community get divided up? What are the main issues?
So obviously there are many, many types of cyclists in Portland, but some of the ones who are the most vocal on online cycling blogs, on Reddit, sometimes within activist circles, are often the really wealthy recreational cyclists who are, you know, on luxury bikes, using it for athleticism. And some of the hot button issues for those groups have been kind of accusing homeless Portlanders of making cycling impossible by because certain encampments are on some bike trails, accusing homeless Portlanders of essentially being the only reason that bike theft happens in Portland, and assuming that all bikes owned by homeless people are stolen. Just generally a rhetoric that is divides affluent cyclists from low-income and homeless cyclists.
Well, the Portland City Council recently passed a ban on people being able to, quote, assemble, disassemble, sell, offer to sell, distribute, offer to distribute, or store three or more bicycles. Also, to own a bicycle frame with the gear cables or brake cables cut, or to own five or more bicycle parts. What kind of impact does that have? How does that factor in?
So that's part of the daytime camping ban, which, as we've seen, the city has not really come up with a clear plan on how they're going to implement that. They haven't done the training. So it's unclear whether this will impact homeless port owners, but it certainly shows a belief among elected officials that all bike repair and bike ownership by homeless people is a criminal activity. And if this is enforced, it will essentially give police jurisdiction to harass and hand out warrants to any homeless people who are engaged in repairing their own bikes, or even who just own multiple bikes and do so as a hobby. And so it'll make it really difficult for homeless people to access the bike repair they need, because not only do people repair their own bikes, but they often, you know, there are key members of a community who provide bike repairs to other homeless people. And this will make that providing that service near impossible.
Is there evidence to suggest that these repair activities are connected to bike theft?
Not really. Bike theft is often a crime of opportunity. So bikes that are unlocked are grabbed and ridden away on. Sometimes they're joyridden. Serious bike theft requires a really high level of tools and a lot of money. So kind of professional bike thieves will have large vans that they fill with bikes. They'll have elaborate tools to cut bike locks. The kinds of resources and those large-scale bike theft operations are not the kinds of things that are being run out of encampments. And also, living in Portland in such a bike-friendly city and a city where so many people ride, it's really easy for homeless people to access bike parts. Even if they are very low income or no income, they're able to find them at salvage days at local bike shops. They're able to find old, broken, abandoned bikes and salvage from those. Bike parts can be bought in bulk online. There are a lot of ways that people can be accessing bikes and bike parts that, our mind shouldn't jump to immediately assume that because somebody is low income or homeless that that bike has been stolen or those bike parts have been stolen.
For your article, you spoke with Andrew Shaw Kitch from Bikes for Humanity. What does his organization do?
So Bikes for Humanity is a low-cost and cost-flexible bike shop in Southeast Portland. They will do very low-cost bike repairs for folks. They accept donated bikes. In the winter, when they have lower demand, they're able to give away bikes. Essentially, and they will also just give away parts that they're unable to sell, but that can be reused in that kind of informal bike salvage economy that happens on the streets.
What role does bicycling play in homeless Portlanders' lives? What does it represent?
Well, so a bike is really the lowest cost form of transportation besides walking that we have available in Portland. TriMet doesn't really cover the entirety of the city. It's not available all times of day. So if, say, you're someone who is homeless and you found a job working at a warehouse in North Portland, which is a really common kind of low barrier employment opportunity, you may need to get up there for the night shift and the MAX isn't running, or the MAX is running, but then there's a, 45-minute walk. And if you have a bike that you can take on the MAX or that you can ride all the way up to North Portland to where those warehouses are out near the airport, that suddenly becomes an employment possibility for you. And if you have a cargo bike, that means that you can be filling it up with cans and taking those to the canning center. If you feel in danger on the streets at night and you have a bike, which means you can get away from anybody who comes up to you and starts harassing you, that it just provides another layer of security. And so bikes have this potential to help people earn income. It can also provide safety from a sweep if your camp is being swept, which, again, with the daytime camping ban, that's if we see that being implemented, that's going to be criminalizing folks being on the streets. But if you're able to load up all your belongings into a cargo bike, you just have that extra layer of protection. And so a bike is a job, a bike is a form of safety, and it's also a very beloved thing for folks. It's, you know, I talked to someone on the streets who said my bike is like my Corvette, you know, and so it's also a hobby for and a love for many people on the streets in the same way it is for many house people.
One of the things your article discusses is this 2022 bicycle counts report from PBOT, which found that cycling counts were down about 35% compared to pre-pandemic levels. What do people attribute that change to?
So, especially in these kinds of online forums I was describing, people immediately attribute that to the fact that there are encampments on bike paths. And especially on the Springwater corridor and on I-205, there's some encampments. And this, the entirety of this decline in cycling gets blamed on those encampments. And this has also been picked up by mainstream media. And it all kind of goes back to this one Twitter poll that a Portland journalist put on online. And you know, some people who responded to the Twitter poll, which was a couple hundred people, said, you know, I don't cycle anymore because of homeless encampments. But there's really no evidence beyond that one poll, which was not a legitimate public opinion poll, to show this. And the real changes that have gone on in the city throughout the pandemic, people are not commuting in the same numbers, and that includes cyclists, and everybody's transportation patterns have changed. And so to attribute this entire decline in cycling to homeless encampments isn't taking in the full picture of how mobility in Portland is changing, and nor will it be the solution to make those cycling counts go up again. And PBOT says that as well. Their official reason for why this has changed is that there have been dramatic changes in travel patterns.
Right, and this is also sort of related to, obviously, funding for expanded bike infrastructure and things like that. And, you know, safety for cyclists is something that folks are often advocating for, but you write that it's more than just bike lanes, especially when you have a more expansive view of who cycling is for. What else does safety for cyclists look like?
So for many people who are either low income or homeless, there are plenty of people in Portland who are riding bikes where the brakes don't work or they don't own lights. And, you know, maybe they're not the strongest cyclist. And there's all kinds of little mechanical issues with their bikes that mean that their bike, you know, doesn't stop very quickly or they don't have perfect control of the steering. And so making sure that people have access to functioning bikes, to bike lights, to bike locks, that is a really necessary part of this kind of advocacy. And increasingly, cycling advocacy organizations are catching on to this. They're saying, you know, Biketown is now offering 5 free rides to anyone on social benefits per day for 1 full hour. And, you know, these kind of bike co-ops often give away parts or do free repairs. And so people are slowly waking up to the fact that if you're a low-income person riding a bike, bike lanes and bike infrastructure are only one part of the picture, because you also need access to a bike that works safely and to protection gear that works safely. And as well, infrastructure is also a huge equity issue for low-income folks, because lower-income areas of Portland are underserved by bike lanes and bike infrastructure. It's just to say that both of those approaches are necessary at the same time, that expanding bike access and bike repair has to go hand-in-hand with expanding bike infrastructure.
You touched on a few of these, but what sort of services exist out there for low-income cyclists who maybe need to make repairs or things like that?
So, I mean, first and foremost is street repairsmen. So there are lots of people on the streets who make it their mission to, you know, are not making huge profits, but are able to fix one another's bikes, to, you know, who have gained those skills over time and are able to fix other homeless people's bikes with a collection of bike parts they keep on hand. And then there's also certain community bike co-ops that do that. Bikes for Humanity, I mentioned. There's also Bike Farm, which does work trade and will teach people everything they need to know about bike repairs. There's the Community Cycling Center, which has salvage days once a week where they're selling at very low prices tons of bike parts. And there's and generally the cycling advocacy organizations like the Street Trust are starting to advocate for greater bike access, to do what they can to give people credits, to sign people up for Bike Town, to do what they can to expand access to people of lower incomes and homeless people as well.
What are the takeaways that you hope listeners get from this story?
So for cyclists who are committed to getting more and more Portlanders on bikes and increasing bicycle mobility in Portland and making our streets accessible to all, I think this can be a wake-up call to realize that there's also an element of class solidarity that's necessary to make cycling accessible. I think for people who are not regular bike riders, it's important to think about the fact that, you know, vulnerable road users include cyclists, they include pedestrians, but among those, the very most vulnerable are the people who are living on the streets and who don't have access to a car to get them around. And so I think that in that sense, as a city, as we look to make our streets safer and more accessible for all vulnerable road users, centering homeless people and centering low-income people in that conversation is what we can do moving forward.
If folks want to read your reporting for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can find everything I write on streetroots.org.
Well, Miles, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Miles Silvey, intern at Street Roots, speaking with me about his new article. It's titled Rubber Meets the Streets: Privilege, Ability, and Legality, the Politics of PDX Cycling. More information available at streetroots.org. This is KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. This is KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. A new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research shows how private equity firms have managed to dominate the provision of autism services in recent years. Co-authors Eileen Applebaum and Rosemary Bott found that between 2017 and 2022, private equity was responsible for 85% of all buyouts of autism service providers. That's the highest rate in any industry. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Rosemary Bott about private equity firms and their increasing control of autism services.
Private equity firms, what are they and what do they do?
So I think it's really important to understand what private equity firms are, because they are taking over many companies in the country, and especially now in healthcare. And I've been focusing on their role in behavioral health and autism services, so I want to talk about that. But they are of great concern because they are financial actors who are not regulated, very lightly regulated by the federal and state governments. And they essentially are large private pools of capital. They raise investment funds from wealthy individuals and pension funds, and they use these funds to buy out companies and, or in this case, autism service providers. And what's important is that they put very little of their own money into a fund. And so they're basically playing with other people's money, and they can take risks with that. So they buy out companies, they use a lot of debt to buy out those companies, and they are loaded on the company, or in this case, the autism service provider. And then they seek to extract money or wealth in a short period of time, about 3 to 5 years. And they promise their investors what we call outsized returns. So they promise that they will beat the stock market. So we have a vision of a fund that is almost like shareholder value on steroids. They need to extract a lot of money from the companies or providers they own in a short period of time and have very little or no regulatory oversight to their actions.
And they're into nursing homes too, right?
They are into all aspects of healthcare: hospitals, nursing homes, physician specialties, radiologists, dermatologists, now in behavioral health. And they consider mental health a hot market because there's so much government and payer funding pouring in to solve the problems of mental health that we are seeing across our country.
Do you know if this is allowed in other countries, or is the U.S. unique in this?
The other countries have private equity investment, but they tend to be more highly regulated. In Europe, there are there's a directive that covers what private equity can do, although there are many loopholes in that. But European countries also have more protections in terms of labor and consumer law, so that they can be protected that way. And in healthcare, for example, the UK, Canada have national health systems that do not allow for-profit entities to a great extent. And in most European countries, the same. So private equity in healthcare is playing a more unique role in the United States compared to other countries.
So as to how these firms came to dominate autism services, was it just that somehow they noticed that it could be really lucrative? Or what was the tipping point there?
So I think this is a tragic story because private equity never cared about autism services, really, until it became lucrative. And the reason it became lucrative is that for a long time, over 10 years, patient advocates and parents fought for healthcare insurance coverage. Autism services were never provided coverage by Medicare, Medicaid, or any private insurance. And so the parents had to go state by state to get mandates passed so that private payers would cover insurance, and then the government as well. So finally, in about 2015, they had managed to get state mandates in virtually every state, and Medicaid kicked in and clarified that it would cover autism services as well as the under Obamacare. So suddenly, the market looked quite lucrative, and we see private equity moving in, and by 2017, it was responsible for the majority of acquisitions of autism service providers. They now own almost 400 autism service organizations and employ well over 30,000 healthcare professionals. They've created massive chains, national chains, with the goal of extracting high returns in a short period of time. And these are private equity firms who know almost nothing about healthcare, let alone autism services, because many of them are these generalist private equity firms that invest in every industry. And they their expertise is in finance, not in healthcare.
So when they take over these autism service providers, what happens to these services in terms of staffing, in terms of the actual care that the people get?
So I'd like to use a recent example to illustrate what happens. There is a provider called the Center for Autism and Related Disorders. It's a company known as CARD, and it's very well known. It was founded in 1990 by a therapist who really wanted to provide services to people with autism. And the owner grew the company over 30 years until it became one of the largest in the country with some 250 sites and 6,000 employees. And at that time in 2018, it was sold to Blackstone, one of the world's largest private equity firms, on the promise that Blackstone would expand services even more because there is so much demand for autism services. And at that time, there was one in 36 kids nationwide who had autism. And so there was a great need for services, and Blackstone promised to expand services. It turns out, however, that Blackstone did not pay attention to the advice of the former owner, and instead it increased layers of bureaucracy, layers of top management. It paid them double and triple salaries that compared to what the former managers had had. Most of the experienced managers quit. Many of them had been with CARD since the 90s. And in just 4 years, Blackstone had closed over 100 sites across the country. And it closed them because it went to states and demanded higher reimbursement rates. And when the states could only raise rates a certain amount, Blackstone decided that the reimbursement rates weren't high enough, and they closed the sites. And they closed the sites last summer in 10 states, all of the sites in 10 states. In the meantime, Blackstone had loaded CARD with about $260 million in debt, and it had pulled resources from the front lines. There was less staffing, less training, less supervision. And in just the spring of this year, it declared bankruptcy. So here you have one of the most successful providers in the country that developed a business over 30 years, and Blackstone ran it into the ground in just 4 years. Now, the owner, the former owner, decided to buy the company, assume some $245 million in debt, and then try to rebuild it in order to serve kids in need.
So what can be done about this? You mentioned the lack of regulation. Is there any move in Congress to do something to bring these companies under control, some sort of control?
Certainly at the level of private equity firms across industries, the Congress has introduced, for example, the Stop Wall Street Looting Act, which was introduced by Senator Warren and others in 2019 and recently reintroduced. And that would focus on constraining private equity, on creating more transparency, on taxing private equity more fairly, a series of things that would curb private equity per se. But beyond that, at the healthcare level, I think we can push to introduce legislation and mandates to require minimum staffing levels. This could be done at the state level, for example, and to require more oversight, transparency, and regulatory monitoring to make sure the quality services are being provided when providers are getting the funding, the reimbursements for care.
The definition of autism, what would you say about that? Is it kind of understood among the general public, do you think, or is it still somewhat of a mystery as much as it's been talked about?
So I think that there's much greater understanding of what autism is compared to, you know, decades when it was viewed as a mental retardation, literally, which was grossly inadequate. And now there is it's serious research that's been done over the last 20 and 30 years to show that there's a spectrum of disorders that range from very, very serious impairments mentally and as well as behaviorally, from those that, to those that are much more mild. And also there's a spectrum in terms of the relative IQ. You can have people with relatively lower than normal IQ and very high functioning IQ. And so there's still much to be learned and understood about the spectrum. But the services that the providers are providing here are often for the children that are have the most impairment and those that are detected when they're very, very young. And if intensive services can be provided in, say, the 2 to 6 year old period, then they have a better chance of then being able to function in public schools or with special education, but in the school system rather than separately.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
I just think that private equity is a form of financing that needs to be brought under control. And what is particularly disturbing is that in healthcare, we're not only talking about the viability of a business. You know, it's not salt we're producing. It's not a commodity. We're playing with people's lives. And so it's really, really important to get the financial actors who just want to make money, to get them out of healthcare and focus back on the needs of people and patients in need of care.
That was Rosemary Bott, a professor in the Labor and Employment Relations Department at Cornell University. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about a report she co-authored for the Center for Economic Policy and Research showing how private equity firms have managed to dominate the provision of autism services in recent years. This has been KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News,